better to prosper in darkness than batter away at some false dawn, like a shroud moth on a lantern. The final movement is neither fast nor deceptive. It is just unstoppable. Vaux thrusts his scythe point first, turning his hands and wrenching the curved blade upwards. It hooks under Zidius's breastplate, bites deep, and keeps on going, bursting his primary heart and slicing open his lungs. Vaux heaves, and the chapter master is hoisted from his feet. Vaux twists, holding him up, feeling the blood gush down the shaft and splash on his gauntlets. Zidius spasms, struggling to make his limbs work, to fight back, to control the hammer that he still grasps tightly. Unbelievably, for a moment, he almost makes it. He almost gets in a final blow. Then, inevitably, he fails. His arm goes limp at last, and the thunder hammer crashes to the ground. His helm is the last to drop, held shiveringly rigid to the end. Gently, Vaux lets the body down. He pulls Exact's blade out slowly, doing no more damage to the already ruined armor than necessary. Zidius collapses, his head lolling. Vaux bows stiffly over his corpse and offers him the old salute, the one that the barbarians used to offer the honorable slain in the days before decay ate its way through all the old protocols. Then he turns to Clado. By the time Vaux lowers himself, cumbersomely over the prone form of his surgeon, Clado is struggling hard to breathe.
What kept you?
Clado rasps. Vaux dips his head closer. He sees that Clado will live, if he is allowed to. The old resilience, the mark of the Legion, runs through all of them. You have to deal out so much punishment, so much extravagant violence to end the Death Guard.
I know, says Vaux,
allowing himself at last to shoot a little poison into the words. Clado has the gall to look bewildered. His bloodshot eye flickers. The red saliva at his ruined mouth foams.
What do you know?
Vaux bends a little lower, so that his helm's crusted grill is next to Clado's ear.
I know it was you, he hisses. You bastard, Clado. I know it was you who moved the ship.
Eight. Iron Shades. Chapter 20. The strike cruiser is coming in fast, piloted with its owner's habitual controlled aggression. Vaux watches it smash through the half-hearted cordon of two world-eaters' frigate-class haulers and make directly for Solus. Its sable flanks glint from the flash of explosions on all sides, but it is being threaded with the determination that marks it out and sets it apart.
"Come about," Vaux orders, gauging how prepared they are for this. "Ready for defensive broadside."
Many look up at him, but only Hovik, poor, ruined Hovik, dares to speak.
"Lord, we are vulnerable," she says carefully. "Lances burned out, damage taken on both flanks."
It only takes a second for Vaux to see that she is right. He allows himself a moment of self-reproach. He had enjoyed the destruction of the Nova Cannon, and has let that colour his judgment. After so long, he ought to know better.
"Well observed," he says,
bowing to acknowledge the correction. He is not a vindictive commander.
"Move us away, then. Just a little time to get things in order."
The orders pass down the chain again, barked with somewhat greater urgency. They are being assailed from many directions, but it is the strike cruiser that causes the most consternation. It is powerfully armed for void combat, enough to trouble Solus in its temporarily diminished state. But in truth, that is not the principal cause of concern. There will be space marines on that ship, all itching to board Solus and start doing what they were built to do. If enough were landed, given all else that they have to contend with, serious and lasting damage could be caused. So they will run for now. They will pull clear, letting the ship recover and the crew restock the guns. A little distance is called for, after which this threat can be dealt with decisively. Solus pivots somewhat clumsily, then boosts hard for the battle sphere's edge. The manoeuvre costs it more las strikes along its back, and a row of biovents takes a raking, but then it is picking up speed. Vaux watches the augurs closely. The Iron Shade strike cruiser is in full pursuit, its thrusters burning white, and it will be in bombardment cannon range shortly.
"Gallowsman," he voxes, "what state the guns?"
Dragon does not reply immediately. Over the link, Vaux hears the discharge of a weapon, followed by what might have been a wet thud.
"Starboard broadside operational in 20 minutes, comes the voice eventually, sour as ever. "Damn sloppy!"
Vaux winces. He does not quite approve of Dragon's robust attitude to the crew, who will be doing their best.
"Very good," he replies. "In form when ready to fire."
They keep running. The battlesphere is still crowded, still perilous. They take more las strikes, scattering across the rear void shields in kaleidoscopes of thrown neon. Solus knocks away a little, straining against the hits, and the deck lets out shrieks of stressed metalwork. Far below, the landings are beginning on Agrippina. Kosalax has launched the planetary assault early, while the orbital zone is a long way from being secured. Vaux catches a glimpse of the big landers being disgorged from the carriers, lines of them tumbling out of their holding cages and burning away into the Forge World's methane-rich atmosphere. This is a gamble. Such impatience could deliver a hammer blow to the enemy, silencing the fixed defense lasers and opening the floodgates, or it could deliver a reprieve if too many transports are destroyed and the focus of the fleet is diverted. Vaux sees that the Blood Angels are already responding, hurtling towards the iron black continent below, as eager to get into close combat as the World Eaters are. How enthusiastic they all are, how willingly they succumb to those indulgent rages. Something feels strange about the ship. Solus is shivering as it runs. Vaux glances up at the forward viewports. He can see the press of ships thinning, the open void beckoning. They just need that small window of recovery, a moment's pause to gather Solus's enduring capacity for revival.
1, 2, 3, say Vaux's silent lips.
Clado moves. This is the moment. This is the chance. The entire ship is in confusion. The population runs from station to station, thrown from their feet and sent clattering across the decks. The Unbroken are striding out to their assigned locations, preparing for imminent boarding actions. The ship itself, that giant sleeping consciousness, is fixated on itself, on repairing what has been damaged. He goes swiftly, hugging the dark. He has rehearsed the route many times, knowing where to avoid, whom to elude. It would be noticed, even in this madness, that the surgeon is not in the apothecarian, and so he has only a little time. Clado is thrilled. His hearts are beating harder, just as they do when he is trying out something new with the needles. In the normal run of things, he would have no chance of leading a warband this size. He is not enough of a battlefield warrior, and such things still matter to those of the old legion. Two things, though, have given him the chance. The first is Vaux's weakness. The Siege Master has been locked in his own obsessions for too long now, neglecting the first business of his calling. He has grown soft, melancholy, wrapped up in arts best left to the Tallyman. And there is Mortarion, too. Clado is of the same view as Dragon, who has made his displeasure with the Primarch's call evident. The great warrior monarchs of the past should have stayed in the past. This is a new age now, one in which new weapons will be needed. The second reason is all around him. All know that Solus is changing. All remark on it. All step around the changing deck layout and push aside the throbbing arterial cables. It has become commonplace, something to smile at as they idly muse on how things will end. Clado knows very little about the mechanics of starships, but he knows very much indeed about the living body. He knows how to dominate the will and shrive the flesh into submission. He knows how to make all sentient creatures his own, to cause them agony and dole out relief in such exact processions that soon they only live to serve, to administer his desires and further his goals. Solace is becoming alive now. Solace is something he can control, and if he controls Solace, he controls the Lords of Silence. His armor is festooned with the instruments of his profession. Needles dangle from loops of tubing. Drills swing from prehensile mechanical arms. His back is weighed down by heavy canisters, all full of the choicest tinctures from his hidden vaults. Philemon likes to think of himself as a master of the occult arts, and Slurt believes himself the most creative of alchemists. But Clado, overlooked Clado, can match them both. They have all been consumed by their own long games and shifting allegiances. Dragon will sulk and plan, and Garstag will champ at the bit for freer slaughter. But they do not have the resolve to act decisively, not like he does. He slips down further, finding his way through paths few of the Unbroken know exist. The air becomes hotter, wetter, closer. His boots sink deep into spongy matter. The liquid pushes up to glisten on the surface. The pipes are thickly clustered here, running in bound parallel courses, throbbing with a semi-consistent rhythm. It is so much like a heartbeat now. This is where it begins. Clado has studied these chambers over many years, probing and measuring. The walls are no longer orthogonal. They curve and sweep. They tremble when touched. He goes further, pushing against curtains of pale grey organics, and the touch leaves a sticky residue of bile against his gauntlets. The pipework is covered in threads of dark veins. The floor is sodden and bubbling. The noise of the engines has long gone, replaced by the muffled boom of that echoing proto-heart's rhythm. Flies are everywhere, instinctively drawn to the truth that Vaux has yet to acknowledge, that sentience has done more than taken root here. It has flourished and extended, burrowing tendrils of awareness throughout the entire structure of this ship, until iron is turned to flesh and adamantium to bone. Clado reaches his destination, a big chamber, many meters high and wide, though the precise dimensions are lost in a haze of drifting corpuscles. Something vast and flabby trembles here, suspended on bowing sinews and lost amid the curls and snags of gristle. It has chambers of its own, mottled sacs that heave and relax. He gets to work. He prepares the vials and links up the various canisters. The shots will travel down his arm into the injectors that he has mounted on the back of his hands for greater control. The quantities to be employed are prodigious. Solace is a big creature, and so will have to be administered with finesse. The air changes. Flies buzz closely around him, mobbing him, crawling over the instruments. He swats a few away, feeling their fat bodies splat against his palms, and carries on. From above, he can just about detect the ongoing noises and movements of void combat, the impacts that send shockwaves travelling down deck after deck before being baffled in the sumps. Clado is ready. He takes a breath. His two hands bristle with injectors the length of a child, each one linked up to the cocktail of neurotoxins strapped to his back. It is rare that Clado prays. He has so little faith. This time, though, he whispers just a fragment, just in case anything is listening.
"Guide this," he breathes, "and I shall create such carnage in your name that the heavens will weep from it."
Then he thrusts the needles in, right up to the hilt, and the plungers slam home. Dragon is shouting. He is striding, moving up and down the long gun lines. Hundreds of crew struggle to get the machinery operational again. Some howitzers have been completely destroyed, blown into lumpy towers of molten metal and entombing their operators. Others are merely out of alignment, and their gangs haul on the rust-thick chains to bring them back onto the slide rails. Every surviving gun angles steeply upwards, rooted in the deck of the ship and pointing up to the gaping gunwales. A filigree of void shields glistens across the apertures, and it suddenly looks fragile. In combat, the gun deck is a very dangerous place to be. It is one of the primary areas targeted by the enemy, and given the need for firing orifices, a catastrophic hit will punch the atmosphere out into the void here more rapidly than almost anywhere else. This has to be done quicker. This recovery has to be more effective. Dragon has access to tactical data the Unchanged do not, and he sees the incoming predators on the long-range scans. They are already firing, sending off range-finding bow chasers, and they are gaining. Right now, Solus is toothless, slow, and vulnerable. Dragon surprises himself with his vehemence. He had never intended to work this hard for Vaux, not in this battle. It was hard to forget Typhus's injunction, and still the words ring in his mind. But combat has a way of reinforcing loyalties. This is about survival now, and he will do nothing to jeopardize it. Not here, not yet. He sees Kodad, the gunnery captain, and shoves his way over to him, pushing aside a tilting ammunition scaffold.
"We need to fire now," he growls.
Kodad nods, his face awash with muck and sweat. Bodies toil in every alcove and under every arch. From somewhere, Dragon can hear the bovine bellows of plague ogrins being goaded into action. Kodad gives the order, no doubt, earlier than he'd have liked. Shouts ring out, bells clang, chains yank tight. Bulky shells slide down the runnels and clatter into the breaches. An old klaxon sounds, though it is washed out and croaky from neglect. The deck judders, throwing up its slops and scraps. Dragon wheels away as the first reports ring out. The immense barrels slam back into their housings, filling the gun deck with smoke. Spent casing fragments fly out, spinning across the deck and rocking to a halt. The crew scrambles to collect them up, to spray thick coolant onto the glowing bracings, to prepare for reload. It is impossible to know how effective the shots have been. Vaux will have a better vantage from the bridge. Dragon moves up the line, spying a crew working a little less hard than the others, its numbers thinned by earlier explosions. He draws his pistol again, preparing to apply motivation. He never gets there. Solus swings around violently. The lumens crash into nothing, then flicker on again, then out for good. Huge crashes, almighty crashes, swell up from below, making the guns shiver in their stocks. For a moment, he thinks the reactors have been hit, maybe gone critical. He has never experienced such wild dislocation, and he struggles to keep his feet. The rest of the crew are less agile and are thrown around like chaff in a thresher.
"Keep firing!" he roars,
reaching out for something to hold on to. He feels sick, strangely. He feels like he has been poisoned. The deck carries on bucking relentlessly. It feels, and this is insane, like the ship is literally trying to shake something off its back.
"Keep firing!"
he shouts again, not knowing whether anyone is heeding his commands or whether this is some terminal spiral into oblivion. He fights his way back along the gallery, clambering over the gun's tangled moorings. Dimly, he registers other data, boarding torpedoes incoming, the ship's gravity center skidding all over the place, conduits bursting open and flooding the atmosphere with sprays of acidic lubricants.
"They are getting in," he realizes,
infuriated and impotent.
"And there is nothing now to stop them."
Clado screams. It has been a long time since he last screamed, and it makes his withered vocal cords throb. Somehow, he keeps his claws pushed down, connected with that shivering mass of flesh, and pumping fear stimulants and mind suppressants into it. The sensory inload is overwhelming, gigantic, all-smothering. Clado had no idea. He had no idea just how far Solus has grown, how powerful it has become. He stares into the ship's mind, its half-aware self, and sees an almost infinite potency there, gigantic, sullen, dull-like fog. He has a choice now. He can try to pull out, to escape with his life and sanity, or he can push on and exert his will over this behemoth. Clado fights it. His fingers squeeze on the triggers, pumping more suppressants into Solace's bloodstream. The electrodes at his temples flare, and he feels the sharp snap of pain as alien matter backfloods into his own circulatory system. They are connected now, the two of them, like a fetus in a womb. Clado has his innate strength to draw on, his knowledge and his long preparation. Solace is barely conscious, a slumbering leviathan, but it is reacting to the invasion, kicking back, wallowing up through the shallows. For a second, Clado sees the prize before him. He sees the vessel's control centers, its ganglia and its long, straggling connectors, lodged deep into every system and structure. He sees the electric glows as the protothoughts shuttle and commute between organs, regulating and feeding. He understands how it works, and almost grasps what would be needed to control it. He reaches out, his consciousness traveling down those same conduits, and has the sensation of vastness, of control. Then he is in the void. He, Clado, is in the void, an immense single object flickering with a coronet of lasfire, powered by colossal thrusters that throb red like a wound. He sees the other objects flying around him, some tiny, some as huge as he is. He sees a sable strike cruiser coming in very close, loosing its cargo of fighters. He feels the scampering of the crew within him, and understands that he could crush them all. A squeeze here, an exhalation there. This is horribly dangerous. This is not what he wanted. Control was the objective, not some merging of minds. Clado fights harder. Somewhere, in another, far-off reality, his fingers stay tight on the plungers, pumping in more of the chemicals. The ship must be rendered dormant, quiescent, turned into something he can enslave. The pain ratchets up. Solace is aware of him. Clado can smell the intelligence there now, blind but clarifying rapidly, numbed by his injections but hard to fully extinguish. It is like a sea, deep and turgid, rolling under heavy gravity, slow but with an incredible, inexhaustible force. This has been a mistake. He has overreached, stretching out for something beyond his ability to hold. Clado has one option left, a concoction he has never tried before, a combination of neurotoxins so potent that every subject he has ever exposed to them died in immediate psychic shock. He had been keeping it in reserve, loath to use it unless necessary. But now, surely, he is out of alternatives. It is still hard to make the selection. He is losing his mind, and he can feel his poisons reverse seeping into his own blood flow. His fingers do not work as they should. His neck is searing with that hot, tight pain. Though he can no longer see, he sometimes knows that the organs around him are swelling, bloating, pressing against him, and trying to crush the life from him. This has been a mistake. He forces a finger to twitch, to click down on that last switch. He can almost taste the poisons gushing, bubbling and frothing as they surge into open veins. Solace wrenches away. It jerks. It spasms. Systems shut down, gasping, and ventricles burst. Clado is hurled away from the link, the needles ripped out, doused in a torrent of inky fuel. The world swings wildly, and he cracks his head against a sparking nest of blown wiring. The ship is screaming, its thrusters gun into full burn, flinging it into a crazed spiral. Repeated thuds slam along its flanks. What are they? Impacts? Explosions? Clado is crawling now. His head is banging with starbursts, his whole body flaring with agony. He coughs up blood. He has unleashed something within Solace, some reaction that is spreading and burgeoning. In a human body, it would be burning towards the heart, choking it off and rendering it insensible. Where is Solace's heart? Where will the shock come? Clado drags himself away. He has failed badly. He does not know what happens next. Where is Solace's heart? Vaux drops to his knees. Everything is exploding. The roof collapses further down the bridge dome, crushing crew beneath its fall. The atmosphere is rushing past him, as if the ship has suffered some major breach, though no such report has reached him. Every signal he receives makes no sense. He's feeling light-headed, bleary. Solus is in agony, and a chain reaction has been set off somewhere. Vork staggers over to an auger station and tries to understand the cacophony of signals blaring across its hololith column. The iron shades are on board, some of them at least, but Solus is now travelling incredibly fast. Cracks race across the ceiling, deep ones that score into the metal struts. He must get out, get away from that danger. The warp drives. He sees the numbers click over, faster and faster. By the God, if that does not stop soon! He lurches, going for a column that will shut everything down, flush the tubes, blow the main interconnectors, and jettison them straight into the void. As he moves, the columns collapse, the roof falls in, adamantium smashes and slams around him, and the cogitators explode into balls of static. Vorx smells the warp and sees the unshuttered real viewers go white. He tries to get away, but the entire bridge is falling in around him.
"Galorsman!"
he voxes, just as the first beam crunches into his helm. He goes down hard, more impacts landing. Blood runs down the inside of his helm.
"The warp drives," he thinks.
Then he's gone. He's out, silent, amid the falling wreckage. Nine. Plague Planet. Chapter 21. Dragan meets up with Philemon in a courtyard just below the fortress's soaring chapel complex. A personnel carrier lies smashed against its far end. It is raining soot, a drifting pall like black snow. His warriors lurch through it, dozens of them, their armor gradually turning black. Far above, beyond the flames and the smoke, the clouds are flickering with strange light. The wind does not feel natural in this place. Further back, Legion rhinos roar their way into the courtyard from the streets beyond.
"You're sure?" Dragan says. "It has already started," Philemon says. "I've attempted to contact the Siege Master. No reply."
Dragan looks at Philemon for a moment. He has always had the Talimon down as one of Vork's closest allies. What is his purpose in this? Is he seriously fostering some kind of revolt at last, or is this just a tactical move to stave off destruction by the Weeping Veil? Perhaps both. Perhaps neither. There is no use speculating, for Philemon is right about the matter at hand. Time is running out, and someone needs to act. Wide stone stairs, heavily gouged, lead up to an open gate. Walls soar up on either side, monolithic, like all imperial constructions, scored with a giant impression of the hated Aquila. Dragan cannot hear screaming any longer. All that remains is the heavy crump of munitions, the low grind of gunships plying between the spires. There is fighting still. The Space Marines are clinging on. Word-bearers and unbroken kill squads are still finding resistance to squash. Naum enters the courtyard then, cracking the stones as he staggers between the disembarking troop carriers. He drags a cluster of bio-cables and armor pieces, black with amniotic residue and the last flickers of electrical power. Others of Dragan's command are en route, and more will come as they heed his call. But so slowly, always so slowly. Dragan turns to see figures emerge from the gates above, word-bearers clad in their dark-stained crimson plate. Dragan climbs the steps towards them, flexing his claw. As he does so, he sends a silent, prepare command to the unbroken at his back. Philemon climbs too, his bolter drawn and his books stowed in chained clumps across his back. Little lords scamper with him, picking up the strips of parchment that fall from the piles, and trying to stuff them back into bundles.
"Stand aside," Dragan says, reaching the gate's threshold.
The word-bearers level their guns. From the base of the stairway, Naum looks up, eyes cloudy with confusion. The ash falls faster, and flames lick across the parapets. One of the word-bearers, the leader of their squad by his markings, takes up position under the gate's lintel, a crackling brass power blade held loosely.
"This place is secure," the warrior says. Find somewhere else to tarnish.
Dragon never stops moving.
Stand aside!
The word-bearer takes a step towards him.
Like I said.
Perhaps he believes the Death Guard have forgotten all initiative. Perhaps he thinks they will shamble up stupidly and debate this with them, or perhaps he thinks that his allies are so thick-headed they would just slink meekly away. Dragon's talons punch through his chest before he has the chance to move.
Aside! Dragon growls, then flings him bodily into the gate's edge.
Bolters open up, a chorus of hard bangs, blowing unbroken from their feet. The Death Guard return fire, and the stairs instantly become a crashing, debris-blasted battleground. Philemon swings into action, firing liberally, escorted by screaming little lords that fly at the enemy, ripping and gouging. Naum lets loose with a dull roar of confused outrage and smashes his way heavily up the stairs, his immense arms already swinging with gathering momentum. Dragon is a whirl by then, a blur of speed and power. He hacks at the nearest word-bearer, gouging lines through the brass and ceramite, before spinning into the next. A bolt-shell whistles past his helm. Another strikes him on the kneecap, but he's still moving, cutting and punching, driving under the gate's shadow. He breaks through the cordon, heading under the gates, and then into chambers where imperial banners have been torn down and trampled. There is blood on the polished floor here, but no bodies. The scale of the architecture around him becomes ever greater. A succession of loftier spaces, solemn spaces, lined and scored with the imagery of the Ministorum. Graven images line the stone walls, and relics of old wars lurk in side chapels where statues of the fallen loom. Amid all the smells of battle, the pungent undertone of incense still lingers. More word-bearers race to intercept him, to prevent the unbroken getting through, and the fighting intensifies under the sorrowful gaze of the Emperor's angels. Dragon drives his way through them, absorbing the hits and repaying them in kind, swept up now and buoyed by his battle brothers around him. Naum is fully engaged, his stupor banished by the sights and smells of battle, flailing around as if truly possessed. He seems to have picked up one of the word-bearers in his left claw, and is using him as a bloody cudgel. Dragon sees more unbroken go down under bolter barrages, and not all get back up. Philemon himself runs into trouble and is soon fighting hard against two determined word-bearers, despite the shrieking assistance he gets from his coterie of little lords. Only one pair of doors remains, gilded with images of serpents and angels, the burnished surface marred by great rents. Dragon can hear something on the far side, a roar, like a sea coming in. Light is spilling from the gaps between the doors, red as embers. He slams into them, breaking them open, and the crimson haze spills across him. Dragon stares out, past the empty-eyed statues, past the lines of candles and the smoky braziers, past the ranks of protective word-bearers and their slaved cultists. He sees what has to be done, what has been gathered together, and finally understands the Talleyman's urgency. From behind him, he hears his battle brothers labor as they fight their way to his position. He hears Naum's huge bellows and detects the helm-laced signals of yet more unbroken converging on this location. But it will all be too late. As he looks out and sees what is about to happen, he knows it must be too late. There is no defeating what comes next, no time to muster a defense, no space to do what must be done. The Weeping Veil have made their move, and now only pain awaits.
What were you trying to do? Vaux asks.
Clado is struggling to speak. That is not surprising. His mouth is a bubbling swamp of blood, and his cheekbones are gone. Zidius was really quite brutally efficient.
Garstag,
Clado attempts.
Yes. Garstag, says Vaux. Working for me. Hunting the ship for me. Asking questions for me. No one suspects him for some reason. Maybe the way he looks.
Clado laughs,
and blood trickles down his ruined chin.
Ah,
he says.
Just tell me why.
Clado collects himself. His breath is filtered through collapsed lungs. Somewhere within his body, the flesh is rapidly re-knitting. He was a space marine once, and his much-altered body retains some of that old restorative capacity.
That chance,
Clado says, chewing on what remains of his tongue.
To master the ship, you won't lead, Vaux. Someone had to act.
So many tell me this. We'll win here, though.
But your habits, your mind, it's gone.
We bring faith to the galaxy. You could have waited, trusted. The rewards would have come.
Clado laughs and winces from the pain of it.
What rewards do you have for us, Siege Master? What rewards does the Primarch have for us? I do not wish to run an old war again, over and over. I wish for something new.
Vaux looks at him.
Then you are a fool, he says. We were given something new once. Look where it got us.
Clado laughs again. It seems he cannot stop.
You are the Legion,
he says.
A weapon made for an older galaxy. You never evolved. We never evolved. I'd have changed that.
Vaux shakes his head.
I tolerated you, Clado, for what you could do for us. In power, you would be an abomination.
Clado tries to smirk.
Yes, I think I would.
He hacks up blood. His hands are trembling now.
But I damaged Solas. I don't know if it can recover.
It already has.
They'll know,
Clado says, searching now.
The others, they'll know.
Vaux moves gently, placing both gauntlets around Clado's neck.
Your wounds were given by the corpse spawn. This was carefully arranged. I will grieve with the others for your loss when your body is found here.
He starts, carefully, to press.
You thought me weak, Clado. Dragan thinks me weak. The Weeping Veil, those deluded pilgrims, they think us all weak. It is in the pattern, though. It is all in hand.
Clado is gurgling. He fights back pathetically, for his strength has already been driven from him.
Everyone asks me what I want, Vaux says. I want what I have. I want this. Here. This is our time.
Clado's limbs jerk. What remains of his face goes red, then purple.
We will make it to Ultramar, Vaux says, softly now. We will fight under the Primarch's banner. After that, who cares? What more could there be but that?
Clado dies, gagging. His limbs fall limp, his chest shudders still.
"You wanted something new," says Vorks contemptuously. "Now you have it."
Vorks relaxes. He looks down at the surgeon for a little while. His expression is just as it always is, that mask of corrosion, the armor mark of another age. He looks up. The gene seed vault lies ahead, whirring faintly. He casts his eyes over the shelves, looking at the ranks of tiny vials. Before he can move, a priority signal worms its way up from the sea of many runes swimming across his visual field. With some reluctance, he activates it.
"The veil have moved, Lord," says Philemon, sounding both anxious and irritated. "If you can hear this, time has run out."
So little faith. All of them. So little faith. Vorks has half a mind to stay where he is and let the consequences of their doubt damn them. He stands, though. He looks around. Then, slowly, he reaches for the incendiary device, the one that will chew through anything organic and render it down to drifting atoms. He primes it and holds it up before the gene vault. For a little longer, he gazes down the lamplit rows, at all the learning there, all the potential, all the power. Then he tosses the live charge, letting it roll along the floor into the vault, and turns on his heels, scythe in hand. There are thousands there, tens of thousands, culled from every cache and refuge in the fortress. They stare, dull-eyed and terrified, chained together in groups a dozen strong, and herded onto the chapel's capacious marble floor. Every shackled group has a robed cultist to guard it, armed with a long serrated knife that snarls and glows with bronze-tipped flame. Above them soars the nave, 50 meters up, its blank stone now swimming with whirling swatches of lurid illumination. In the great voids, in the curving vaults and the iron-lined shafts, energies have been kindled, spiraling in mid-air like nebulae. The images, hanging in stately isolation, are all defaced, turned upside down or scratched out. Crude octeds, 6 meters across, have been engraved into the granite tomb faces. The flames snap and ripple across them. These are the citizens of the Sabbatine who took refuge in the citadel, dragged up from the deep places, chained together, and hauled into the chapel. Their faces are grey, their mouths slack, staring at the swinging lights as if mesmerized. Their clothes are ripped, hanging off them like ribbons, their movements sluggish. Cult priests swagger among them, carrying flails and smouldering censers, declaiming in a language Dragon does not understand. Other cultists, arranged in choirs around the edges of the crowds, are chanting, repeating a sequence of syllables over and over. The sound makes the stone itself resonate, a vibration that thrums up from the crypts below, running up the pillars and shivering the high arches. Dragon has emerged through east-facing doors set several meters above floor level. He can see word-bearers stationed all through the grand chapel, at least 100, guarding every ingress and overlooking the teeming throngs. He hears Naum and Philemon fighting in the chambers beyond, sloughed into combat by those outside and struggling to make headway. Even if they slaughtered all that opposition in moments, they would struggle to make any dent against those ranged against them in here. He can already feel the rites accelerating. Dragon has little sympathy with the nature of the warp, but he does not need to. A child could detect what is happening. The chapel's ceiling is already translucent, bowing under the enormous pressures from above. He can see frail shapes on the far side, enormous figures coiled like fetuses, struggling hard against shackles imposed by the damaged physical universe. There are three of them, gigantic beyond reason. One is lithe and disturbing, a pale shade with barbed hands and a crown of thorns head. Another is bullish and blood-red, already roaring. The third is bird-like, spindly and scrawny, but reeking of sour magics. They are so close, tearing at the thin wards that keep them from bursting into physicality. In their wake, he detects legions, cohorts, ranks of the Neverborn on the cusp of spilling down from that incipient rift, scrabbling with cold fingers to make the leap into reality. Such desecrations are easier now. This is what they are learning, what the priests of sacrifice already know. He cannot understand why Vorx was so trusting.
"Desist!"
Dragon roars, preparing to vault down from the balcony to make at least a gesture of defiance. At the far end of the nave, the Master of Ceremonies turns to face him. He has taken himself up into the great imperial pulpit and stands beneath the shadow of a desecrated Aquila. Dragon recognizes Mor Jalchek's veined armor from the Iamanda, the tides of black flame that hiss across his ceramite plates, the crozius that he now bears openly and unchained. The apostle is surrounded by his retinue, a motley collection of the warp-sick and the void-touched. The air is singing. It tastes of blood already, and there is more to be spilled. Rage is futile here, for the preparations have already been made. There is a crackle of ozone, a leap of green-edged lightning, and a gust like storm wind races down the long, tall nave. Before Dragon can move, he feels the ice chill of a warp translation, a teleport, or some other location shift sorcery wrapped in a smoky cloak of foul, fly-blown detritus. Vorx shudders into being at the opposite end of the nave, far from both the pulpit and Dragon's vantage, his outline clattering with broken hoarfrost, his scythe glassily caked in it. As the ether winds gust, he looks briefly magnificent, unveiled into hidden splendor with bone-pale armor and an erect, warlord-like bearing, before the clouds thicken about him again, his spine curves and his battle-plate curdles, and he is just Vorx once more. The Siege Master, relic of the ancient world, thrust like a canker into the agonized present. Mor Jalchek deigns to acknowledge him.
"In time to witness the taking of this world from you," he shouts, his hard voice ringing down the long vaults. "You should never have shown us the way here."
Vorx stands there, isolated, the last fronds of his sorcerous passage still spitting around him. He does not respond to Mor Jalchek, but shoots a final glance, meaningfully, at Dragon.
"Do nothing," he voxes,
a dry whisper among the cacophony of massed chants and cries. The apostle raises his crozius, which crackles and shudders with black flame gusts. The air is ripe now, ready to catch, spitting like boiling oil. Naum's cries are still audible, getting closer, but Dragon follows the order, remaining where he is. Mor Jalchek throws his arm down again, sweeping it like a dagger strike, and every priest on the floor of the chapel plunges their knife into the heart of a captive. Then they work their way through the crowds, going quickly, expertly slaughtering in their practiced, efficient ranks. The flames in the braziers leap, the air flexes, 100 blades flash again and again, the crescendo of sacrifice that will rip the last shreds of the veil aside and unleash the demonic apocalypse. Dragon looks up to the translucent vaults. He braces himself for their collapse, for the rush of the Neverborn and the hurricane of murder. Every word-bearer in turn lifts his blade, saluting the eldritch army they have ushered into being. Mor Jalchek cries out in ecstasy, a shout of triumph that echoes from chancel to chancel. And nothing happens. The priests keep stabbing, but the bodies do not fall. No blood splatters on the marble, just a thin black dribble where the steel is withdrawn. The citizens sway a little, wince a little, but then the blank looks return. The priests grow panicked and hack away, but nothing changes. Nothing is sacrificed.
"They are already dead, Mor Jalchek," says Vorx dryly, the cloud of flies growing around him, multiplying exponentially. "Stab as much as you like. We got to them first."
Mor Jalchek is slowly realizing the truth. He calls out to his warriors, and they lower bolters at the crowds. The priests, seeing what is happening, scramble to get out of the way.
"There will be no rituals here," Vorx says calmly, striding down from his teleport locus and swinging his scythe in lazy arcs. No demons, no magics, no gifts from the gods. We have claimed this world, and our plagues now encompass all of it.
The word-bearers open fire, sending volleys of mass reactives into the crowd. The mortals go down in clumps, blown apart and hurled into one another, but still no blood is spilled, and still no souls are released. These are just meat sacks, flesh puppets and revenants, the product of Slurt's piped poisons, and no god will dignify the culling of such spoiled goods. Dragon finds himself laughing as he watches. He looks out at the terror on the faces of the priests and laughs harder. Vorx is striding into the heart of it now, swinging his scythe in those crushing parabolas, taking on the word-bearers who are belatedly turning to face him. Above it all, the vaults begin to solidify, darkening back into stone and iron. The whirling lights fade as an angry howl of frustration shimmers across the gulfs. And now the flesh puppets are rising up too. They are limping towards their tormentors, reaching out to grab at the necks of the robed cultists and drag them into the quagmire. The word-bearers wade into the midst of them, firing solidly, but even they begin to get bogged down, snagged into a thickening slush of clutching fingers. Naum finally emerges then, smashing his way through the wall behind Dragon and lurching wildly into the fray. More unbroken pour through the gap, locking onto the fighters of the Weeping Vale, firing with steady precision. Teleport loci begin to whirl into life on the fringes of the chapel, all of them pale green and tainted with blowflies. Garstag strides out of a mist of smashed crystal, his armor seething from the transition and his toothed chainsword snarling. This is carnage now. This is sudden, glorious carnage. Dragon leaps from the balcony, crunching down to ground level, and races at the beleaguered word-bearers. They are suddenly easy prey, hampered by the bodies lurching into them, stricken with uncertainty. Dragon lashes out, catching one at the neck with his talons. The warrior swings round, shaking him off and aiming his bolter. But Dragon is already at him again, cracking the weapon away and going for the throat. The blades bite deep, severing the helm and wrenching it off. Then he is moving further in, striking out, hunting the next target. The numbers have turned. The crowds are almost inexhaustible, a half-living wave of insentient meat that clutches and throttles. More unbroken arrive, and Dragon begins to realize that they were not all summoned by him. This has been planned, timed, measured for maximum impact. There is calculation here. There is numerology. He fights his way out into the center of the nave, beginning to feel the sharp kick of battle lust again, the first time he has enjoyed it for a very long time. Soon he is with Vorx, and the two of them charge the enemy, scythe and talons in concert.
"Most trusted servant," says Vorx dryly, slicing across a retreating apostle with that terrible blade. "Siege master," Dragon replies, falling in alongside, joining in the killing.
Chapter 22. That is not quite the end. It is a defeat, one that forces a hurried withdrawal, but it is not quite the end. The apostles of the Weeping Vale remain cohesive, and they remain powerful. They are driven from the chapel by force of numbers, and the sudden switch of momentum. But Morjalchek does not die in the rout. He leads them out into the shattered remains of the fortress, and there they rally. For a while after that, the outcome remains uncertain. Remnants of the White Consuls make a final counteroffensive, led by their captain Memnon, which retakes one of the main bastion towers. The Death Guard, having committed heavily to contain the threat at the chapel, are beaten back across three other sectors by vengeful squads of word-bearers. Amid the smoke and the debris, orders are lost, mistakes are made. The attrition rate begins to bite, and gunships come down in gouts of burning promethium. But the time of decision has been passed, and now fate runs in one direction only. Slurt's toxins have filtered through every part of the Underfortress, and more of the living dead emerge, steadily adding to the hosts that now march with the Lords of Silence. The threat of the Neverborn recedes, The barrier between worlds does not weaken further, and soon the only demons stalking down those flame-raked streets are plague-bearers and little lords, spreading their blights gleefully like pheromones. With his great objective denied him, there is only so much of this pain that Mor Jalcek is willing to tolerate for Sabatine. After a savage feint in which an entire segment of the inner citadel is demolished by timed incendiaries, his orbital landers finally fight their way down. This is a dangerous maneuver, and a number of the dropships are lost before they can pull away again. But a substantial proportion of the Weeping Veil makes it into orbit, pursued by the Death Guard's surviving Thunderhawks. With their numbers thinned and their pride crushed, there is no reckoning to be had in the void, and the Iamanda beats for the Mandeville Point. Vorx lets it go, for there is still hard fighting on the surface, though he permits Hovik to shadow for a while, keeping all guns trained on the cruiser until it retreats fully into the void. Then there is merely the slow death of the fortress to be attended to. The last of its defenders are hunted, run down in their final bastions, overwhelmed at last by the air that chokes and the flies that blind. The baseline humans by then are either truly dead or corrupted by the gathering smog, and it is only the Space Marines who remain, incapable of despair, even as their world finally comes crashing in on them, and all hope is snuffed out. There is no wanton cruelty. Vorx is true to his word. Those who are not killed in the fighting are given an honorable death. Countless numbers of humans are inducted into the half-life of thraldom, their wills extinguished and their souls crushed. But the Lords of Silence do not see that fate as something to mourn. For them, it is an improvement on what went before. And so Vigilia Carceris is taken, its foundations scoured, and its archives burned. Little lords dance across the proud parapets, defecating on the symbols of the immortal Imperium, while the waves crash futilely below, starved of their energy by the unnatural humidity. It will be recorded in later years that this was the first great loss of an Adeptus Astartes homeworld in the aftermath of the Cicatrix Maledictum. Scholars on Terra will make note of Sabatine's destruction, and fear that it presages the start of an unstoppable tide. Events will be set in motion as a result, decisions made, desperate pacts sealed. At the time, though, whether on Terra or within the Imperium Nihilus, none of this is guessed at. All that is known is that a battle has been won, and the god of decay has been well served. The last of the flags come down. The guns fall silent. Hunched monsters with pale green eyes emerge into an uncertain haze, their movements slowing again, their helms venting breathily. Over the burning metal and the rotting flesh, a pall descends. Slowly, uncertainly, as if all such mundane things are now to be questioned in this universe of change, it begins to rain. He stumbles through the ruins, breathing heavily. The pain in his chest seems to have gone now. He barely remembers he had it. He does not see well. Everything is grey, like rancid milk. Other bodies, rough around the edges like his, are like ghosts. Occasionally, one will blunder up to him, and they will stare at one another, trying to recall something important. Then the other one will lose interest and shuffle back into the mists. He has killed many people. He knows this because their blood is still hot on his hands. He licks this blood from time to time, and for a while afterwards he feels more defined. It is not necessarily a pleasant sensation, for the pain comes back quickly too, and his eyes are sore. It feels better to sink back into that vague sense of not quite there, the blurring of awareness, and the softening embrace of dreams. He is conscious of a narrowing. It is like the world is closing in around him, both fading and becoming heavier. He is permanently cold now, and things are drying up. He does not sweat, and his mouth is parched. He limps past the sharp edge of a bombed-out building. One half of an eagle motif, double-headed, lies in the ruins. He stares at it for a while, wondering why it is making him feel terrible. He doubts that he could be properly sick now, even if he wanted to, but the feeling of nausea is still possible, so he hurries on. Eventually, he is on the edge of the city. He can smell salt, and he feels a chill wind against his face. He shivers, wondering if he should go back the way he came. The walls are little more than piles of broken stone. He could just keep on walking.